Morning. We'll be returning to that passage at the end of our sermon. Thank you, Randy, for reading that. We're going to spend our time this morning considering a subject I think we all have struggles with to one degree or another, and that is selfishness. Selfishness is something we have to be sensitive of evaluating and identifying in our lives because, by its own definition, it's going to be difficult to spot selfishness in our lives. It's going to be difficult to identify when we are being selfish. When we're concerned primarily with our own interests and not thinking of others, it's difficult to stop and objectively consider whether or not we are being selfish. I remember several years ago, my father-in-law told me that having children will teach a person just how selfish they are. I can now personally attest to the accuracy of that statement. It was an eye-opening experience to all of a sudden have this person in my life who keeps me up at night, who makes me tired, who takes up a lot of my time. The next thing I knew, I was complaining about how tired I was, getting frustrated in the middle of the night when the baby's crying, getting mad when he didn't take long enough naps, being frustrated that I'm not getting as much done as I used to, I don't have as much time to read, I don't have as much time to do the things that I enjoy. And even then, it took someone older and wiser than me to point out the fact that this was just selfishness on my part. But the best thing to do, and the only appropriate thing to do, was to get over myself and realize that life isn't about getting what I want. Quit complaining and love and take care of my family. Yet even after this continuing experience, I still don't do a good job of recognizing it when I'm being selfish. I may be more aware of it than I was before, but there are so many times when I have to check my attitude and get over myself. It is a real struggle for me, and I would expect that I'm not alone. Selfishness seems to be a problem everyone struggles with, some more than others, but I think all of us have selfishness that we struggle with in our lives. We don't have to go very far in the Bible to find the first act of human selfishness. This is a bit of a subjective question because it's not explicitly stated, but I'll ask it anyways. Who was the first person that we have recorded in the Bible to carry out a selfish act? Who was the first person? We'll go before that, actually. I think you can make a strong case that it is Eve. I think you can make a strong case that it's Eve. Now, we're not told explicitly that she was being selfish, but let's look at this passage in Genesis chapter 3, specifically in verse 6. It reads, "So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate." This is a selfish act, isn't it? She was making a decision based on her own perceived self-interest. Well, that fruit does look awfully good, doesn't it? And it would be great to become wise, to know good and evil like God does. She neglected the concerns of herself and others, most notably God, and thinking only of herself and what she wanted. She desired wisdom. She looked at the fruit and it was good. She desired it. She acted selfishly and took it. Now, it doesn't take very long until we find our next act of selfishness in the Bible, is it? The one that Paul noted, Cain. If we look over in Acts chapter 4, we find that Cain brings an unacceptable offering to the Lord. It does not say what was wrong with Cain's offering specifically. We do know that he offered fruit from the ground in contrast to his brother offering a lamb from his flock. But what we do know is that what Cain offered was what Cain wanted to offer. It wasn't what God wanted him to offer. He was selfish offering this sacrifice. It was the product that he grew. It was what was convenient for him. And we could even continue and talk about the selfish act of Cain murdering Abel. But if we continue with this process of pointing out people's selfishness from the book of Genesis through the book of Revelation, we'd be here for a very, very, very long time. Selfishness is arguably involved in every sin that we commit. It was certainly in the two sins that we just looked at. Let's consider a few passages that I think can demonstrate the involvement of selfishness in sin. In 1 John chapter 2 and verse 16, we find that it reads, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world." The reason sin entices us is because it feeds on our desires. It feeds on our perceived, and I think that's good, that's a really important word to use there, our perceived self-interest. Like Eve, we see the fruit. Whatever the fruit represents for us, whatever it is that's tempting for us, we see the fruit and we lust after it. It looks good. We'll think it'd be good for us. We think it'll give us wisdom in Eve's case, or pleasure, or happiness. And out of this selfish desire, sin is conceived. James chapter 1, verses 14 and 15 read, "But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death." This is the path to sin. We have a selfish desire. We allow our selfishness to control our actions. And we can see that selfishness is a contributing factor to the sins we commit. And not only is it a contributing factor to the sins we commit, it is also a contributing factor in most of the conflicts that we have with one another, with other people. There are problems within a family. Selfishness is a contributing factor. There are problems in a marriage. Selfishness is a contributing factor. If there are problems in a congregation, in a church, selfishness is a contributing factor. If you disagree with me, I would like you to demonstrate the one time where that's not true, and I think you'd have a really difficult time finding that. Because anytime you look at conflict between two individuals, I think you can find at least one of them, if probably not both, are motivated somewhat by selfishness, are thinking somewhat selfishly. No matter how much or how little we struggle with selfishness, if we can all be a little less selfish, our relationship with God will benefit, our families will be more stable, our marriages will be stronger, and our relationships here at the church, and what we do for one another will be enhanced. The difficulty is still identifying selfishness in our lives and doing something about it. As I said before, the very nature of selfishness makes it difficult to objectively evaluate and identify it in our lives. So what I hope to do this morning is spend our time looking at passages that I think have to do with selfishness. Selfishness is not explicitly pointed out in all of the passages, but it's my opinion that it's certainly implied in all the things that we're going to look at. We'll look at these passages and try to make some possible applications, and hopefully by doing this, we'll be able to walk away with something this morning with some tools that equip us to identify this in our own lives. I'm going to divide this into two different sections. First, we're going to consider selfishness as it relates to our relationship with God, and selfishness as it relates to our relationship with one another. There's obviously some crossover between these two, but I think it'll help to categorize it that way. So we're going to start by talking about selfishness in our relationship with God. It is easy to be selfish in our relationship with God. It's easy to begin to think about what it is that we want out of our relationship with God, or what it is convenient for us to do in our service to Him, in our worship, or we only give God the portion of our lives that we're willing to give up. Let's look at a few examples in the Old Testament. I want to first start off in Zechariah chapter 7 and look at verses 3 through 5. That's Zechariah chapter 7, verses 3 through 5. If you'll turn there with me, please. I'm going to read that passage. Actually, we're going to back up into verse 2. "When the people sent Sherezer with Regemmelech and his men to the house of God to pray before the Lord, and to ask the priests who were in the house of the Lord of hosts, the prophet, saying, 'Should I weep in the fifth month and fast as I have done for so many years?' And the word of the Lord of hosts came to me, saying, 'Say to all the people of the land and to the priests, when you fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh months during those 70 years, did you really fast for me?" For me. Zechariah preached shortly after the children of Israel had returned from Babylonian captivity and rebuilt the temple. And he's prophesying on the other side of the captivity. And apparently during this time they had periods where they would weep and fast. I'm unsure of the context of the fast that was done in the fifth month that's referred to, but it's possible that this was a tradition that was established during the captivity. And now the question is being posed to the priests whether or not they should keep this tradition in light of their return to Jerusalem. And God's response to Zechariah, or through Zechariah, is really interesting because he doesn't give him a direct yes or no answer. As opposed to providing a direct answer, it became a critique of their attitude while fasting. Note the manner of which that they ask the question. This is the people. Note the manner of which they ask the question. Should we continue this thing that we have done for so many years? If I'm reading this correctly, if I'm understanding this correctly, it looks like they're asking the question because they may be a little bit tired of doing it. Do we really have to do this anymore? Is it really necessary? And at the end of verse 5, God responds with a question of his own. Did you really fast for me? Was it for me that you were fasting? Were the weeping and fasting for God, or were they weeping and fasting for themselves? The implied answer is in verse 6. When you eat and when you drink, do you not eat and drink for yourselves? Just as they ate and drank for themselves, they were weeping and fasting for themselves and not for God. And it's amazing how often God asks this same question in some form or another throughout the Bible. Often he points to the actions of people who profess to be doing work for the Lord and point out the fact that it's just vain exercises on their part. God even makes the point with Zechariah that this is the same conversation that they had prior to the captivity. We're looking at verse 7 of the same passage. Should you not have obeyed the words which the Lord proclaimed through the former prophets when Jerusalem and the cities around it were inhabited and prosperous and the south and the lowlands were inhabited? They had this exact conversation before the captivity. Let's look at a couple examples of this. Let's turn over to Hosea chapter 6 and look at verse 6. And Hosea prophesied before the fall of the northern kingdom. So this is some 200 years before Zechariah would prophesy. And in verse chapter 6 and verse 6, we find this statement from God. For I desire mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. The point that's being made here is that God is not concerned just about the act, but about the heart as well. It's about knowing the God whom you are serving, not treating him as some abstract being that we go through the motions to appease. God also laments about these very same sacrifices in Isaiah chapter 1, 13 and 14, where it reads, "Bring no more futile sacrifices. Incense is an abomination to me. The new moons, the Sabbaths, and the calling of assemblies, I cannot endure iniquity in the sacred meeting. The new moons and your appointed feasts my soul hates. They are trouble to me. I am weary of bearing them." God was criticizing the Jews for performing their sacrifices simply because that's what they were supposed to be doing. It became a cultural ritual to them. There was no real worship going on here. Let's look at one last example. Malachi chapter 1, verses 7 and 8. Look at this one last passage and we'll think about maybe some practical applications. Malachi chapter 1, verses 7 and 8. "You offered defiled food on my altar, but say, in what way have you defiled you? In what way have we defiled you? By saying the table of the Lord is contemptible. And when you offer the blind as a sacrifice, is it not evil? When you offer the lame and sick, is it not evil? Offer it then to your governor. Would he be pleased with you? Would he accept you favorably, says the Lord of hosts." The people in this conversation that God was talking to were not giving the best of their flock for their sacrifices. Instead of offering their prized possession, instead of offering the lambs and the animals without blemish, they were offering the things that they would throw out anyways. The blind, the lame, and the sick. And this is no sacrifice to God. In all these instances, it all comes down to selfishness. These people who were worshiping God were more interested in what they wanted than what God wanted. The sacrifices offered up to God were simple motions to appease people's conscience, to make them feel like they were fulfilling a duty and being righteous. It was not done to give God praise and worship, but to meet their own selfish needs. Is it possible for us to have these same selfish attitudes in our relationship with God? Can the purpose in our hearts for our service be for us and not for Him? Can our offerings of worship be empty because we're thinking more about ourselves than God? And the answer to those questions is yes, it can. Even though we're not making animal sacrifices, we can mirror image all of these actions in our own lives. Our motivations can be selfish. Our offerings can be empty. Like the Jews in Zechariah, we can be selfish by choosing to worship based on our own convenience, what we would like to do, We can ask those same questions that those people ask. We've been doing the Lord's table on Sunday mornings, every Sunday morning, for a really, really long time. Is that really necessary? Do we really need to do that every Sunday morning? We've been doing this a cappella singing for a long time. Do we really need to continue this? We can ask those same questions that the people did back in Zechariah. We can easily become fixated on what is convenient for us. But our daily service to God and our worship is not necessarily meant to be convenient. If you have any doubt of that, then spend some time looking at the old law. There's nothing convenient about the worship that they had to prescribe then. There's nothing convenient about our worship to God now. Like the ones condemned in Isaiah and Hosea, we can show up here for service and offer empty sacrifices by not considering the words we sing, by not focusing on the prayers that are offered, by not paying attention to the sermons and the readings, by doing empty words and thoughtless effort. Like the people of Malachi, we can offer lame, sick, and blind sacrifices by giving God our leftovers. We spend our time and energy on other things and simply give Him whatever we have left. These things are all rooted in selfishness. We want our time and energy to be devoted to the things of the world we enjoy instead of to God. We are being selfish. When we come here and don't devote ourselves entirely to this service, we are being selfish. And these are just a few examples of selfishness that can creep in our lives. There's a lot of other examples we can talk about. We can talk about our prayer life. Do we only go to God and occasionally when we have some reason for ourselves to go to God? Or do we have a devoted prayer life where we continually give Him praise and thanks for the blessings He's provided for us? Do we serve like the Pharisees that we talked about this morning during class, so that they'll be seen by men, as it says in Matthew chapter 23 and 5, so that others will have a good opinion of us? Or is our service devoted truly to God? And we could go on for a long time with this list. The bottom line is we can't selfishly look for the things we desire in our relationship with God. We have to look for what God desires in our relationship and base our relationship with Him on that. And our desire for the relationship and God's desire are not always going to be the same, so we have to continually look for God. Look to God. For I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. Now let's switch gears and turn over to Matthew chapter 14, please. We're going to spend a few minutes talking about selfishness as it relates to our relationships with one another. We're going to look at Christ as our example in putting aside selfishness and serving one another. I think chapter 14 is a good scripture to look at. In the first 12 verses of this chapter, we find that John the Baptist is beheaded by Herod. And in verse 13, the passage turns to Jesus and how He reacted to the news of John's death. And let's read that. This is Matthew chapter 14 and verse 13. When Jesus heard it, and that's the news of John the Baptist's death, when Jesus heard it, He departed from there by boat to a deserted place by Himself. But when the multitudes heard it, they followed Him on foot from the cities. Jesus' reaction to hearing about John the Baptist's death was to depart from the crowds and find a deserted place where He could be alone. It's apparent that Jesus is wanting to have some solitude here. He wants to remove Himself from the multitudes for some time. And my guess is He was mourning the death of John the Baptist. We're not explicitly told why He was seeking the solitude. But given the closeness of their two mothers' relationship and the fact that they were related in some fashion, it's likely that Jesus had known John well. Jesus certainly thought high of John. In Matthew chapter 11, He said that there had been no greater man born among women than John the Baptist. But in any event, for whatever the reason, Jesus went away to be alone. We found out there in verse 13 that the multitudes followed Him. That even though He wanted solitude, the multitudes, when they heard the message about John the Baptist being beheaded, they followed Jesus. And we find in verse 14 Jesus' reaction when He sees the people. And I think here's the lesson for us. When Jesus went out, He saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion for them and healed their sick. Despite Jesus' condition, He sees the people and He places His own needs and His comfort aside. In Mark 6 and 34, which is a parallel passage to this, He likens the multitude as sheep without shepherd. These were people who needed help. His people were leaderless. They were ignored by the leadership of the nation. They were searching for direction, not knowing where to go, not knowing what to do, but they found hope in Jesus. And they sought for him, and they needed Jesus. And here is Jesus wanting to be alone, wanting to mourn the loss of a friend. And as opposed to remaining in solitude where he obviously wanted to be, he put his own comfort aside and went to see to the people's needs. In Matthew, it says he came down and healed the sick. The passage in Mark, it says he taught them. He came down and was the shepherd they needed despite his own troubles. Jesus' humanity gave him the same physical and emotional frailties that we have. He could be tired. He could be troubled in spirit. He could be discouraged. And yet, time and again, we see him placing those things aside for the benefit of others. In a sense, offering himself up so that he can help and minister to others. And as always, Jesus stands before us as our example. Serving others is rarely convenient. It often requires self-sacrifice. But it's easy to look after and worry about our own problems. Sometimes when worldly cares press us, we can become physically exhausted and emotionally drained. And it becomes even more tempting to look to our own comfort. But Jesus shows us here that we have to be cautious when we consider ourselves. We can rarely, if ever, place ourselves first. We need to be mindful and aware of the needs of others. What is it that others need us to do? What do we need to do to help them? We may not be as comfortable as we wish. We may take further strain and fatigue upon ourselves, but that is the example we're given from Jesus. And if this is how God wants us to react in times of trouble, then how much more does he want us to do when our lives are relatively trouble-free? Being there for one another, thinking first of one another. Let's turn over to 1 John chapter 3, the passage that Randy read for us. I want to zero in on verses 16 through 18 of this passage. 1 John chapter 3, verses 16 through 18. I'm going to go ahead and reread this. By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us, and we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. Verse 16 first establishes the necessity of laying down our lives for one another. And then we find in verse 17, John gives us a specific example of how we can care for one another. And I read this passage to be talking specifically about physical possessions. I think the term the world's goods make that distinction. We have food, clothing, or shelter, and there's a brother who is in need of these things, and we do not provide it. John says that the love of God is not in us. The love of God would compel us to share our blessings with one another. But broaden the thought back to verse 16, to the statement made back in verse 16, utilizing Jesus as an example of laying down our lives for one another. John gave a specific example of sharing worldly necessities, but I think there is a broader theme here. In what ways did Jesus lay down his life for us? And the obvious answer is that he did go and die on the cross, but there's so much more than that that he did during his lifetime. Jesus did not only die for us, he lived for us. Philippians chapter 2 and 8 talks about Jesus being obedient to the point of the cross. The cross was the culmination of a life of obedience, of a life of service. It was a life of serving God and of serving others, just like the example we saw in Matthew chapter 14. And if we start looking at John 3, 16, 1 John 3 and 16 through 18 within this broader context, I think we can see that the practical application of these verses reach beyond our physical blessings. We have people who are around us who are in need. They may not need food or clothing or money, but what they do need is our encouragement. They need our time. They need our effort. They need somebody to be there for them. And if we shut up our hearts to their needs, how does the love of God abide in us? How does the love of God abide in us? And if we begin to think in these terms, a life of servitude, it will impact the foundation of how we make decisions. Like Christ, we need to make our decisions based on the need of others and not on our own selfish tendencies. And under this mindset, church attendance no longer is about what we get out of service, but what we can put into the service. What we can put into it to benefit the other people that are here. And I'm not talking about just simply participating in the public service, but being here to shake people's hands, asking them how they're doing, offering them an encouraging word. We're here for one another, not for ourselves. Under Christ's mindset, when we are asked to participate in the church service, whether it's teaching the young kids class on Wednesday nights or the sermon on Sunday morning, we're not looking at it as an inconvenience to ourselves, but an opportunity to help and encourage one another. Under Christ's mindset, when we're going through hard times, we don't forget about others. We don't forget about their needs or stop being concerned with what we can do to care for them. We don't grow bitter about what we're going through and the sacrifices we are already making. We set aside our selfish tendencies and pay attention to the need of others. Under this mindset, we're not treating service to others and God like meeting a quota. It's often tempting to keep a mental checklist of the things that we're doing for others to use as a gauge of which we're of whether or not we're doing enough. And I think honest evaluation is a good thing, but we need to be careful how we perform this. This is dangerous, and it can't be what Jesus did. Christ would have looked at serving others like meeting a quota as a checklist. He would have hung his hat and gone home long before he made it to the cross. We should not be asking ourselves if we're doing enough for others. We should be asking ourselves if there's more that we can do. So let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. Selfishness can be a plague on all of our houses. We can see time and again people in the Bible allowing selfishness to rule their lives, and it always ends in sin and conflict. We can look at the world around us and see selfishness ruining the world's families. We can see it as a root cause of the death of countless numbers of unborn children. We can see it causing people to place their careers in front of family, free time in front of God, and pleasure above morality. Selfishness is a subtle mindset that pulls apart or cripples our relationship with others and our relationships with God. I've said it twice now, and I'll say it a third time. The nature of selfishness makes it difficult to objectively identify and evaluate in our lives. We have to be vigilant in uprooting it in our lives, uprooting it from our lives. And hopefully what we talked about some this morning will help you with that effort. Early in the sermon, I mentioned that we have a tendency to follow our own perceived self-interest, and I noted the importance of the word perceived. Because it's never in our own self-interest to follow sin. It's rarely in our best interest to be selfish. Eve is a great example of this. The fruit looked good, but the consequences of her actions were disastrous. That fruit probably tasted very good. It provided her with a moment of pleasure that she was looking for. But the result was disastrous. Being selfish may seem like it helps us in the short term, but it won't help us in the long term. It is actually in our best interest to be selfless, to serve one another, and to serve God. In the short term, we may not seem that that's true, but in the long term, it's unequivocally true. If you're here this morning and you have not yet committed yourself to God, we're going to offer you the opportunity to do that at this time. This is truly an opportunity that's always open, but we take this moment to encourage you to do so. If you've recently been thinking about the sin in your lives and the fact that you are in need of a Redeemer, there's no reason to wait to have that taken care of. There's no reason to wait for accepting Jesus Christ as your Savior and being baptized for the forgiveness of your sins. There's no reason to wait till tomorrow. So if you wish for us to help you with that this morning, we ask that you come forward and as we stand and we sing the invitation number that Alan has announced.